Well, welcome back to the Second Court of Appeals, everybody. We're honored today to have a visiting justice with us, Justice Charles Blyle. And I think we only have your one case this morning, which is Bonsignor versus State, cause number 214-146-CR. If the clerk will announce counsel, who will be arguing today? All right, Mr. Burns.
It pleases the court. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Jeremy Aaron Bonsignore. This was a plea of guilty with an intent, with an agreement to appeal the motion to suppress the blood draw in his case. The case of McNeely came out just before our trial. We raised the issue. We were raising it anyway. And the question really comes down to whether or not the McNeely case, no question on the status of the law that it applies to our case. It came out while our case was still pending. But the question becomes whether or not somehow the Texas statutes trump the federal constitution. And I'll admit that the Court of Criminal Appeals is granted rehearing to address that issue in Villarreal, which was a great case and still is, and hopefully it'll stay the same way. And I've been trying to.
Mr. Burns, if that's really the question, could there be more than one answer?
Well, if you mean can they come either way, I mean obviously the court can reject their agreement, but I've been trying to think of a way that the courts, you know, they're arguing that the statute somehow exempts them from following the U.S. Constitution. I mean, how else could that be addressed?
How could a statute exempt them from following the U.S. Constitution?
I don't know, and that's their argument, though, that because the Texas Transportation Code provides that you don't need a search warrant if you've been a drunk or convicted of driving while intoxicated.
But does it really say that? I could not find the word warrant in the statute.
I'm sorry?
I could not find the word warrant or don't need a warrant or any words to that effect in the statute. It says the officer shall or is required to obtain a blood sample if a defendant or an accused has been convicted in two prior DWIs, but I don't see where it exempts the officer from having to get a warrant.
And I like that reading of the statute, because the statute doesn't provide that somehow they can avoid the statute. Everybody was going under the old federal court. I mean, yes, the federal court's exemption of Schumberger. That, well, you know, because alcohol was so ephemeral, you couldn't get a search warrant. But we've proven that's wrong. They're getting search warrants all the time, and in fact, as of January 4th, 2013, the officer involved in this case had obtained more than 30 search warrants for blood draws. So he knew that provision was there. He probably knew about McNeely working his way through the courts, and he had gone out and gotten them. And there was no indication that any of those prosecutions had failed because it took so much time to get a search warrant. That's just not a good exception. I've been trying to think of a time when the state has argued that somehow a statute, state statute, trumped and the requirement to get a search warrant in a valid search case, and I couldn't think of one until 3:40 this morning. And I recall two times when we have tried
that. You were
up
too early or too late, one of the
others. I just woke up, yeah. I'm going, wow, I can't remember. I remember that back in the early 70s. It shows how long I've been around, but not sure many members of this court were even alive at that time. But the there was a murder exception, a murder scene exception to the search warrant. If there was a murder scene, you could just go on into the house, examine it because, you know, this person has been killed. We need to get that killer off the street. And that, you know, later was declared unconstitutional. The state also had a exception, a second exception to having to get a search warrant, and that was the fire marshal exception, where there was a fire and there was some indication that they don't know how the fire started. The fire marshal could go in and check out and find out, you know, what that was, taking whatever samples and such that he could. And they could go back, and you know, there was no exception to that. But finally, we got rid of the fire marshal exception as well, because you have to get a search warrant. And the fire marshal can, at the time, while there's still smoldering stuff, debris and such, go in just, you know, to examine and try to see if he can determine what it is. But once he leaves, he can't come back without getting a search warrant to go through that. You know, poor Walt Cleveland, you know, he still has a right to privacy in the slab of his house. You know, they burned down about a week ago. They can't go in. I mean, he still has his privacy rights, and that's been recognized again in the fire marshal exception. Officers.
Let me ask you this question, though. Isn't the statute trying to statutorily define or prescribe circumstances in which we are required to look at certain factors in determining the reasonableness of the search in light of all the circumstances? In other words, here the state could say the need is greater because of the past history, and so that these things that are listed in the statute make the search more reasonable without the warrant.
The problem with that is, and we're saying that we can we lose our right to privacy and our right to the protections of the Constitution because we've been a criminal in the past, and we can't reform or be rehabilitated. We don't try people as criminals in general, and that's what the statute is effectively saying, that you lose that right.
It's tied to the two prior DWIs, which is more case-specific, I would argue.
But even if you have two prior DWIs, does that mean that you're guilty of the third one? Does that mean that, in fact, you should not have a right to privacy because you've had two prior DWIs? If you've had, as one, and I can't recall the name of the case coming through here, a gentleman who's had 50 public intoxications and 12 prior DWIs, that still doesn't take away his right to a trial, his right to due process, and his right to a Fourth Amendment protections. The fact that you've been a drunk in the past doesn't mean that you're still, on this particular occasion, a drunk, and that you've lost all your rights. I would submit the fact that, in this case, Mr. Bonsignori had the intelligence and the forethought and the normal use of his mental and physical faculties to say no. I mean, that to me shows that he wasn't intoxicated. I mean, you know, it's the drunks who say, sure, go ahead and take my blood. But that's an argument that the state puts forward. Plus, you know, Officer West, they had two officers working this case. So there was no reason why Officer West, who was the arresting officer, couldn't have worked and gotten a search warrant while Officer Gomez was taking Mr. Bonsignori to the hospital to get this draw. I mean, it's not like there was a loss of time. They had Officer West at the office filling out paperwork. Why couldn't he have gotten the search warrant? All you do now is fax it off, put your little check marks in there, and any additional factors you think may be necessary to establish probable cause. The judge signs them. They got judges around the clock, and they fax it back. And it's not like it takes a lot of time. It's not like that it's impossible to get. The Constitution can be inhibiting to police work and police prosecution. I was trying to find between 3:30 and this morning, and now some of the old murder scene exception cases, and my database at that time of the morning didn't go back far enough. But Brimage v. State, 918 Southwest 2nd, 466, shows the types of arguments that the state can drop to. They argued that a burglar could give consent to go into a house because they said there was signs of foul play in the back room of the house they were burglarizing, and so they used his consent to get in, and that didn't work. And they argued, well, this is a really big exception. It was exigent circumstances, and that didn't work. Mr. Brimage got a new trial. And Mr. Bonsignori should also get a new trial and be tried without the illegally seized blood evidence. We would ask the court to consider the fact that the statute in this case doesn't take away the requirement to get a search warrant, and that it doesn't relieve or make the Fourth Amendment disappear. Under Texas law, as the Court of Criminal Appeals has this year reemphasized, there is no good faith exception in Texas, thanks to 3823 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure. And as long as that's there, then you can't have a good faith exception unless you have a search warrant. Now, if you got a search warrant and there's a minor error or a typographical error, as long as the search warrant establishes probable cause, then you can have good faith exception in Texas, but not absent a search warrant. Therefore, Mr. Bonsignori was entitled to a search warrant to draw his blood, and we would ask the court to so find and give the Court of Criminal Appeals the benefit of your reasoning in the case that they're now deciding again on Villarreal, that this is a clear case where a search warrant was required, could have been acquired, and is a violation of the federal and the state constitution, Article 1, Section 9 of the Texas Constitution, as well as the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. And unless there are some questions, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. All right, Ms. Dehoning.
It pleased the court. I'd like to favor the court with two cases that were not originally in my brief. On April 22nd, the Court of Criminal Appeals granted Cole. That site for the case is 454 Southwest 3rd, 89. That's a Texarkana case, and petition was granted. It's PD 007715, and that case is another McNeely Villarreal case. And it also includes the 3823 issue as a granted issue. I mentioned in my brief that Weems and Dowds have that issue because, of course, the lower courts decided the 3823 issue. They had more of a generic McNeely issue granted, so you would have ultimately gotten to the 3823 issue on remand, depending on the outcome at the Court of Criminal Appeals. But this one is directly on point with the 3823. 3B issue.
What was the second one? You said Dowd and what
those two are in my brief, Weems and Dowd.
Okay.
And I mentioned that they have that. Weems, it's W-E-E-M-S. It's a case from San Antonio, from Bexar County, and Dowd. And so you have three that impact 3823, but the Cole is smack dab on point on 3823.
The petition has been granted in Weems too, right?
Yes, it was the second one that was granted. It was argued. There's actually eight cases currently on submission or under submission as of, I think, a week or two ago at the Court of Criminal Appeals, and I believe I've listed those in my brief, and I can certainly provide the court with my latest little update of all of those too, if you would you like that list?
Sure, if you can want to provide it in just a supplemental letter brief, and then we'd give opposing counsel an opportunity to respond.
Well, I will just list out the cases. I won't include any argument, so I have leave for that, Your Honor.
Yes, you do.
Thank you.
Have
Thank
any
you.
Of them been set for oral argument, or is there a date that we're looking at?
They have actually all been argued or submitted on briefs at this point. I don't believe argument was set for Cole. It was just granted, so it's still not yet under submission. The other seven have been submitted. There were arguments in the fall. The state prosecutor attorney had two arguments in one day, the same day as Weems. Actually, my list of the cases has on it the dates of submission and that sort of information, so instead of you guys having to write it all down, I'll happily provide you with my continuing list of the McNeely cases. Then I just also want to note, this court decided last week a habeas case in Ex Parte Sarah Elizabeth Westfall. It doesn't impact as far as the legal analysis, but it's definitely another McNeely case, and so I didn't want to argue today without mentioning that y'all had another case that you had decided. I think it was Justice Dauphineau's opinion. And of course, you've had several other cases that you have decided out of this court, and they're adverse to the state. And we have many, many cases across the state. Basically, the way I describe it, we are all in a holding pattern. It's like when there's a storm cell over DFW and you're circling around for a while, forever, waiting for the Court of Criminal Appeals to decide Villarreal and the other seven cases that are granted and under submission. And to a certain extent, truly, until they do that, we'll learn which way we're going. You looked like you had a question, Justice Blyle.
No, I just wonder if the Court of Appeals is supposed to wait on the Court of Criminal Appeals to make those decisions, and it seems to me they may or may not this year or next.
There are no rules for how long a case stays under submission. Some of us have had cases. I had a case, how can I not think of that name? Charles Ford. Oh, my goodness, how can I not think? I had a case under submission at the Court of Criminal Appeals for 4 years, years and years ago, and I believe that Belva Myler, the old district clerk, or the clerk of the court from years ago under Tommy Lowe, told me that was the second longest. Chadrick Ford, that was a name. Scott Brown and I had that case. And there was a Dallas Allen Martin, not from this county, that was under submission at the Court of Criminal Appeals for 5 years, I believe. So mine had the second longest submission. Those are unusual, though. I'm going to be hopeful and anticipate a decision soon, if not by the summer, and certainly in the first hand-downs in the fall. And I don't think there's a rule for whether or not a court is required to do one or the other. I think the courts can choose to do what they want, and you have your own, I suppose, internal rules for when you hand down cases. Some courts have not handed down McNeely-related, Villarreal-related cases, and some courts has. This court has. I received an opinion a few weeks ago from the El Paso court, which, of course, was transferred from here in one. So I don't know that there's a right or wrong way. It's however the court chooses to do its take care of its internal calendaring and scheduling. But clearly, what happens in Villarreal and the other cases impacts this case. So I'm not going to suggest one way or the other. You know, this kind of reminds me, not in my brief, but years and years ago, there were cases like Rose error. Rose error was the parole law error in the late 80s. And oh my goodness, how many cases were there on that? And, you know, they had carts with shucks on them at the Court of Criminal Appeals, where they'd have all of the Rose error cases, and they were waiting on deciding them themselves before, you know, handing them all down. And when the Speedy Trial Act under Michelle was found unconstitutional as a separation of powers violation, it was the same thing. There was a domino effect. Later we had Garrett error and domino effect, and some of the jury shuffle cases, Chadwick Ford was mine, where there was actually no longer automatic reversible error on those cases. And so we often have cases where it impacts something that is litigated in our courts over and over. And obviously DWI cases are litigated for whatever reason, perhaps more than almost anything else, and so this is clogging up the courts. I am certain that the judges in Austin know that everyone is waiting with bated breath for their decision. This case actually, though, you have facts in this case where you could actually decide it without waiting on Villarreal, and I have pointed out in my brief that there are exigencies here that would allow you to consider this case outside of the statute. And of course, McNeely itself in the opinion says, gosh, we know there are going to be cases where an exigency applies, and Schmerber is alive and kicking still. And in this situation, we had circumstances of the offense, but they were not like a car crash causing more time to investigate or facts like that. We're dealing with a small PD. The officer's testimony is before you, and Lake Worth PD has 3 to 4 officers on duty at night. So this was a situation where they unfortunately only had 3 officers on duty at this time. And leaving that last officer at the station was something that they chose not to do, even though Mr. Burns is correct, 2 officers were involved in this, but 2/3 of the police department was involved in this one DWI. You know, that may or may ring true as an exigency to you. Of course, we're dealing with a situation from a motion to suppress where the non-prevailing party did not ask for findings of fact and conclusions of law. So we go with the court's ruling and read the record so that the inferences in the record support the court's ruling. So I think there's a reasonable inference that the court here believed there was an exigency because they were decimating the Lake Worth PD. And, you know, it's not the first time that we consider officer safety and having one officer back at the station for whatever crops up in Lake Worth. If you just think of another line of warrantless cases where we haven't trumped or done horrible things to the Constitution or the Fourth Amendment, how about Terry, where we have less factual support for officers' lawful warrantless conduct, but it's based on officer safety over and over, and so we don't want to leave an officer hanging there all by himself to respond to whatever crops up in the middle of the night at this small PD. So anyway, that's circumstance of the offense based on this being a small agency, and as the record shows, there was no magistrate there. They had to utilize a Fort Worth magistrate. The officer said the week before this hearing, I think it was the week of or the week before, he had actually obtained a warrant because it was post McNeely and they were obtaining warrants all the time, and it took 3 hours to do that. So we know what kind of time considerations we're looking at. We also can't forget what Justice Sotomayor said. We can never forget that the evaporation of the alcohol from the blood is always happening. So we have an ongoing exigency. Of course, we remember that McNeely didn't wipe out exigencies and actually didn't address the validity of these statutes at all, actually cited the statutes, not saying good or bad, but noting that they provided limited situations where officers obtained blood, without saying that was a horrible thing or a violation of the Constitution. In this situation, though, it's always present. It's just not a per se reason for exigency, and that is really the only narrow ruling that the United States Supreme Court made, as pointed out multiple times in some of the additional opinions. You know, and then, as you pointed out, this is a recidivist case. It's a serious case. I also cited the court to Welsh versus Wisconsin. That was a case from years ago where the Supreme Court considered a DWI. And in Wisconsin at that time, I think it was in the 70s, the person who committed the DWI was thought to have been a first offender at the time it happened. And in those days, a first offense DWI wasn't just a misdemeanor, it was a civil offense. Times have changed. But it wasn't even a criminal offense. And the officers chased the guy down to his house. He skedaddles upstairs and is inside his house, and the officers enter warrantlessly to seize him, which, if that had been the civil violation, that would have been a problem. But it was still a de minimis sort of situation. They found out later that he had another prior, so it ended up being a criminal case because he was a recidivist. But they said you have to consider the severity of the offense in determining the exigency. Well, we have the other side. We have the felon here, not the first-time offender, not someone who's just barely getting into the criminal realm. And we have statutes that consider the severity of the offense in other scenarios. Under Chapter 14, we have broader warrantless situations when you can arrest felons versus non-felons. Also, just to point out how statutes do not have to trump. They apply the law. They apply the Constitution. And Mr. Burns was thinking up old cases that have now been overturned with the murder exception that he was speaking of. Well, in 2007, Judge Cochran decided Miles, which is in my brief, and that's a case that talks about 1816 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. And she says that statute codifies exigency. Okay, that's the statute that allows officers to make a warrantless seizure of property to avoid the consequences of theft. Had that happened just this last year when my daughter's bike was stolen and then they found it, lo and behold, and officers seized it and without a warrant. That sort of, just because we have a statute that asks for a seizure doesn't mean it's trumping the Constitution. This statute's reasonable, and that's why the state has repeatedly said, in addition to the exigency here, that reasonableness is the linchpin of the Fourth Amendment. We have a narrowly defined item that's being seized in a certain type of case, only the most serious, where it's a felony or someone's injured and they are at least transported to the hospital. And under those very circumscribed scenario where you have probable cause already and someone with diminished expectation of privacy because they are cuffed and going to jail already, in all of those situations, that makes this statute reasonable. And that's why we continue to file our PDRs and stay the course until we find out what's going to happen in Villarreal and the other seven cases. And then, of course, I'll just again say we want to go with what happens in Cole as far as 3823 applying, because we believe that because there's no violation following the United States Supreme Court's decision in Kroll, where a law changes, no one here can debate that this officer was doing something devious or had any sort of chicanery up his sleeve when he was getting the seizure without a search warrant. He had a statute that was ubiquitous across the country that officers had been using for years and years and years with very little flack in appellate courts of any sort. You know, if they didn't have probable cause, in this situation, the Court of Criminal Appeals had certainly supported these statutes. So he was following the law, and we don't want to get rid of evidence when officers follow the law. The whole point of the exclusionary rule is to protect officers when they follow the law and kick the evidence out when they don't, because that's what we want to make sure they do in the future, is follow the law.
Ms. Dehoney, it seems to me a primary tenet of your argument is we should wait and see what the Court of Criminal Appeals does, and I understand that. I know firsthand that once upon a time, ethics violations were filed against the chief judge and the court for holding under consideration one case for 3 years without a decision and another for 5 years. Of course, nothing came of that complaint. But it seems to me if every criminal case that comes before the courts of appeals should wait for the Court of Criminal Appeals to decide it, if there's something similar or related pending?
Well, I'm in a catch-22 because this court has clearly decided to issue opinions. I truly think it's the court. I'm surprised, and I'm thinking that is not in the Texas Courts of Appeals, or it's something that I don't know about, but I can't imagine that there would be an ethics violation for a court deciding to wait for a higher court to decide something that controlled.
I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to say that courts of appeals would violate. I've never known of a court of appeals.
Okay. Okay.
Been on a case that long, and in fact, there is some oversight for them.
Sure. Office of Court Administration, I'm not completely privy to how that works, and that happily is not in my job description. So
I guess I'm just trying to say I don't think it's a very good argument to wait to see what the Court of Criminal Appeals does before we decide a case.
Well, and in that situation, y'all would kind of be backlogged with lots and lots of cases, which is, I assume, why you have issued opinions in this. Otherwise, you know, you'd be dog paddling, holding your head up, you know, under the McNeely cases. I think that my last count, we had 33 hearings in our county. Not all of them continued forward as far as cases that are either appealed from the defense or the state. But I think I have at least three or four state appeals at this court. I have basically close to a dozen McNeely cases. So I feel your pain on I would like a decision from Austin on this.
Is it the district attorney's opinion that the transportation code of the state of Texas overrides the Supreme Court decision?
No, well, see, and actually, we don't think that the McNeely decision decided. In fact, it did not decide. McNeely did not involve an implied consent statute. It involved an exigency situation where the prosecutors there, who did us no favors, tried to push a per se rule. And I do realize I'm just responding. My clock is, I'm not trying to ignore time.
I'm through it.
In no way do we think that McNeely actually decided this issue. I think McNeely only went to the general provision that there is not a per se exigency, and I think it was pretty nutty of those prosecutors to argue a per se exigency, because if you go back and search Fourth Amendment law through the years, the Supreme Court has said, no, 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 we don't have per se rules on Fourth Amendment issues. So that truly is what it decided. It was not a case that involved their implied consent statute. This is what has grown out of reading the opinion more broadly than what it did. And that's our position, and that's so we do not think it invalidates our statute.
Thank you.
And I had just one question that goes back to the first one I asked. Does the DA have a position on that the statute allows warrantless blood draw?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm glad you asked me that question. I know there are a couple of the courts of appeals who have said, well, gosh, they could follow the statute and do a warrant. I guess you could read 1816 that way, too. Gee, you can seize the evidence that you're trying to prevent the consequences of theft if you get a warrant, too. I don't believe that there is a warrant and the statute requirement, and I just think that's a mistaken analysis.
Do you can you clarify whether Villarreal has been withdrawn? Petition has been granted. I mean, motion for rehearing has been granted.
There were two motions for rehearing that were filed. Mm-hmm. They were granted in February, and it was resubmitted in March without argument, which is the first time I'd seen. Actually, it says on their docket sheet submitted, but I mean, it's the second time it was submitted. It was also, there was another case that was a Villarreal-related case argued at that time, too. I'm losing track right now of which case that was, but I will submit the list of cases to the court that has that information. But so I believe that the first opinion is no longer any good, whether it's
still out there. It's still available.
Well, yes, but we can also go back and read lots of other cases that have been re-decided. And often, sometimes, the Court of Criminal Appeals, when a case is granted on rehearing, for instance, I'm thinking Almanza would be one. There's several where the opinion on rehearing is either after the original opinion when it's published or before, and I've never figured out why one way and why the other in different decisions, but that always behooves people to make sure they've read everything through the whole opinion, because sometimes that subsequent opinion. You know, another one that was completely turned around years ago was Montgomery, which is a case we cite all the time, but it started out with an original opinion that did not go the way the ultimate opinion did. So.
All right.
Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Honey. We appreciate your arguments. Mr. Burns, rebuttal.
Very shortly. I would simply point out again, an argument that, well, it took so long to get search warrants that the officer West testified that he had gotten 30 before Mr. Bonsignori was even arrested on January 4, 2013. So it was not all that difficult. Second thing is this argument that somehow you should wait for the Court of Criminal Appeals. It's sort of, I would submit that as the Supreme Court has many times done, said, well, we're not going to take a case under discretionary review because we haven't had the lower courts make their decisions and give us the benefit of their knowledge and their reasoning. And I think that the Court of Criminal Appeals would greatly benefit from this court's reasoning and decision in this court while they are contemplating their decision hearing in Villarreal. And for that reason, I would ask the court to go ahead and work this case up and make a decision, and then one side or the other can go to the Court of Criminal Appeals and on to the Supreme Court from there. But we'd ask the court to consider the issues here and to find in favor of Mr. Bonsignori and to reverse his case and remand it for a new trial. Unless there are other questions, I'll give you back whatever time I have. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Burns, thank you. Ms. Dehoney, thank you. We appreciate all of your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is now submitted, and this being the only item on our morning docket, we will now adjourn court.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now standing adjourned.